problem. It's really not an easy thing to implement. And I totally understand why people maintain monoliths for such a long time, because going to a microservices architecture is very difficult. And so I think that just appeals to me to try and pick it apart. And I think I did mention that, again, I've looked at some reference architectures, and often what I like to do is pick them apart and kind of reverse engineer them to see if I can get them to work.
Hello and welcome to Committing to Cloud Native, the podcast where we talk about committing to both open source and the cloud, how they go together, how they work to make a better internet world, and how we're here to make sure that we can continue doing awesome stuff with cloud technology. Today, we have two other panelists besides me. I'm Richard Littauer.
Hello, everyone.
We also have Justin Dorfman. Justin, how are you doing?
I'm great, Richard. How are you?
Doing good. Thanks for being here. And we have Zuri Bar-Yochai. Zuri, how are you doing?
Doing great, Richard. Thank you.
Excellent. And because we don't necessarily like recording talking to just ourselves, we also have a guest on today, as is normal. Our guest, however, hopefully is not normal, but rather an exceptional person. I'm really excited to introduce him. We have Les Jackson. He's calling in today from Melbourne. He is a developer advocate at Marketplacer and has done a ton of really interesting stuff in this space. Les, how are you doing today?
I am very good, thank you, and very flattered that you would call me exceptional. I'm not sure that's the case, but I will accept your compliment. Thank you very much.
So, Les, you also do a few other things. First off, to just background, to me, it's really obvious that you're not actually Australian. I went to the University of Edinburgh. I lived there for 5 years, and you sound pretty Scottish to me. How did you end up where you are?
Well, that's a good question. So you are very much correct. I am from Scotland originally. I'm actually from Glasgow, which is like the other big city in Scotland. I moved to Australia about 11 years ago. And when people ask me why I did that, there isn't really a good reason. I had a visa that I had applied for just sort of randomly, and it was going to expire. So I thought, well, now is as good a time as any. It was really just a change I was after. And yeah, it's worked out pretty well. Been here 11 years, so yeah, it's a nice place to live.
It would be. One of the things I really like about your Twitter handle is that it's binary thistle, which shows that you're from Scotland. The thistle is the national flower of Scotland, quite thorny, but also binary, right? So you're interested in code. So you moved to Australia 11 years ago. How did you end up as a developer, and how did you get to where you are now?
Sure. Well, I mean, the developer journey started way back in Scotland, in the UK. So I went to university in Glasgow. I did a degree in computer science, which was predominantly maths, which I probably should have researched the course a bit more thoroughly. I thought I was just going to do a lot of coding, but it was mostly really heavy mathematics, which was okay. Anyway, I joined when I left uni. I was fortunate enough to join the sort of national telco, which is British Telecom. So big company, lots of opportunities there. And I really started as a developer there. And that's really what got me started many years ago, more years ago than I would care to mention. Looking at the young faces around the room, I'm probably the oldest person here. But yeah, that's what got me started. And then, interestingly, when I moved to Australia, I'd been in the UK working professionally about 11 years as well as a developer in various other roles. And when I moved to Australia, I actually decided to make the change to move away from coding. And I moved into business analysis for a while. And that's what I did here for many years. And then more recently, I've moved into my role as a developer advocate, which is a kind of nice blend between almost sort of business analysis and coding and talking and teaching and stuff like that. But yeah, started my developer journey a long time ago, over 20 years ago.
A lot of developer advocates do start as developers, and just so that they know how to talk to developers, and they realize, well, actually, they like talking to them more than they like necessarily coding all the time or dealing with managers or whatever you want to call it, which makes a lot of sense. What do you do as a developer advocate for Marketplacer?
So Marketplacer, I suppose I'd call it a startup. It's probably coming out of that phase now. It's past the startup phase, I would say. About 100 people. We've mostly in Australia, but we have opened a US office in San Jose, I think it is. So growing quite rapidly. And my role there really is to help people integrate into the platform. So it's probably not, I wouldn't really say it's even a traditional developer advocate role. When I think of a developer advocate, I tend to think of people going to conferences and getting people on board onto someone's API, for example. That's not really what I do. It's more working with our clients who tend to be larger, I don't know, I suppose e-com customers who want to integrate into our platform. So I work with their development teams to allow them to integrate into our platform predominantly. Do a lot of documentation writing, which I quite enjoy. A lot of people hate documentation, but I actually like writing documentation. And working with onboarding teams, working with product team to consider new features for our APIs predominantly. So yeah, it's maybe not a traditional developer advocate role, but it's one I really enjoy. It's a good role.
What are the main frameworks and languages that you're using as part of that job?
Over there at Marketplace, so the application is predominantly written in Ruby, and I've done a little bit of Ruby, but if you've watched my YouTube channel, you'll know that not really. I focus on other languages, but yeah, Ruby, TypeScript, JavaScript. We're very lucky there because we do get to experiment with any number of languages that we want to use. So I know somebody's written some modules in Go. I've written some stuff in C Sharp, obviously. So yeah, but predominantly it's a Ruby on Rails shop, and then the front end is React, JavaScript, and a bit of TypeScript.
So you're not just doing developer advocacy, but you also have the .NET Playbook.com and a YouTube channel. Are those the same things? Can you tell us what the YouTube channel is?
It's a bit confusing, to be honest with you. Yeah, so look, my kind of brand is, it's actually really confusing. My brand is, or my Twitter handle is Binary Thistle, yeah. So the YouTube channel started out as with that branding. And then when I sort of tracked, when I got into it more, when I kind of looked into running a YouTube channel more, one of the bits of advice that I picked up on was perhaps you should use your actual name. So I kind of switched it to using my actual name. The .NET Playbook is just a thing on the side, which is really a blog, to be honest with you. And as the name suggests, it's really, I suppose, quite long articles on taking you through step-by-step guides on how to do a particular thing. The reason for that I decided to create a blog, I was on holiday in Vietnam and I got incredibly ill. So I was in this small room, incredibly hot, fevered, and I didn't have anything to do other than having my phone. So I thought, what can I do to occupy my mind? And I thought, I know what I'll do. I'll create a blog. And so I spent half that time just coming up with the domain name that I was going to use for this blog. And it went through many iterations. So maybe that's why it's a bit disjointed, because I was in a kind of strange state of mind when I was coming up with this concept. But yeah, look, the two things are kind of interrelated. I interplay them between each other. So I'll refer to the blog when I'm making my videos, and I'll refer to my YouTube channel from the blog. But they're kind of the same thing, but branded slightly differently.
Besides a blogger, you're also an author, and you wrote the ASP.NET Core 3 API. Is that right?
That is correct. So the genesis of that was the blog, .NET Playbook. And again, I bought a book. I can't remember who it was by, but it was about technical blogging. And one of the things they really suggested you do when you have a technical blog is that you try and build up your mailing list. And that sounds like quite an old school concept, but the idea behind that is you actually own your mailing list, whereas I've got quite a few subscribers on my YouTube channel, but I don't really own those subscribers. I can sort of contact them, but if YouTube decided to shut me down, I lose all those subscribers. I don't have access to their email or anything like that. So I don't really own my subscribers. That's the way I look at it. So that was another reason I decided to create a blog, because I thought, well, I can maybe own my audience a bit more. Anyway, coming back to my point, I wanted to kind of get people to sign up to my mailing list. And I thought, well, people aren't just going to, well, they might do. They might just come to your blog, like it, and sign up. But I thought, how can I entice people? What can I use as a lure to lure them in to sign up to my blog mailing list? And I thought, well, what I'll do is I'll create a small ebook, just maybe 20 pages or 50 pages, something really small. Call it an ebook and say, look, if you sign up to my blog, you'll get a free copy of my ebook. And that was the original idea. And then what happened was I started writing this book, and it just got bigger and bigger, and eventually kind of turned into this full book, really. And I self-published for a while, and that did quite well. I published on a platform called Lean Publishing. Any aspiring authors out there, I really recommend it. Fantastic platform. You get to keep most of your royalties. It's got some really nice authoring features. Great platform. Also published on Amazon, of course. I think you have to kind of do that, really, to, you know, get as big an audience as possible. And the book did okay in the self-publishing kind of domain. But then maybe a bit after a year, I was approached by A-Press. They do a lot of IT books, I guess you'd call them. And they said, look, you know, do you want to publish through us? And having never published a book before, I thought, well, why not? Let's give it a go. And yeah, that was maybe just under a year ago that kind of was published. I think it was published last October. by A-Press. So yeah, it's been an interesting insight into how actual publishing works as opposed to self-publishing.
Was that like a bucket list checkmark? Write a book and get it published?
Well, I think it is for a lot of people. I mean, what do you guys think? Is it something that you would consider?
Oh, yeah.
Definitely. Probably not API tutorial, but definitely writing a book. Yeah, high up there.
Yeah, I suppose it was a bucket list item. And that's actually why I agreed to do it, because there was a lot of work involved in the editorial process. When you self-publish, you're basically just you. I mean, it was just me, really. I didn't really involve anybody else. And I actually did the editing myself, which is probably the worst. Like a developer testing their own code, it's a big no-no, but I didn't really want to involve anybody else, to be honest with you. When you go with a publisher, though, there's a technical reviewer, which is obviously awesome. There is the editorial staff who actually edit, review your English and use of grammar. So as a Scottish person, my English sometimes isn't that wonderful. People sometimes say, is English my first language? But yes, so they picked up a lot of grammatical errors, let's put it that way. And then, yeah, the actual publishing itself, typesetting, all that kind of stuff is very interesting, but very lengthy when compared to self-publishing. So I'm not sure it's something I would do again, to be honest with you. And that's something I would say to you guys. If you have a means to market to an audience, and I had my YouTube channel, then I would very strongly consider self-publishing. You have much more control, and you get to keep most of the revenue, whereas the publisher, I won't mention numbers, they basically keep the vast majority of any money that the book makes, and you get what's left, which isn't a lot. And considering all the work that you had to put in to get it to that point, I mean, they have to invest a lot as well. Don't get me wrong. There's a lot of work that goes into it, but I wouldn't probably do it again. I would write a book again, maybe, but I wouldn't actually publish a book again. But I'm glad I did. And if I had to make the same decision again, I would make the same decision again. It wouldn't be something I wouldn't do, but yeah, I probably wouldn't do it again. I'd self-publish though.
Good to know. So I found you through YouTube and you were doing a Envoy tutorial, and I just thought it was very fascinating. And supposedly it's like one of your top videos. And what got you to say, you know what, I'm going to do some cloud native content?
So I'm really interested in microservices generally. And my microservices journey kind of started back at my last company, which was another large telecoms company in Australia, the big one, the big incumbent here. So they were going through a bit of a transformational phase, and they had a lot of big monoliths hanging around. And they kind of decided, number one, to kind of approach software development from an agile delivery perspective. And then they also decided to go down this microservices route, which I thought was really interesting. And those two things, as I'm sure you're kind of across, they're very intertwined with each other, speed of delivery, all that kind of stuff. So that's kind of what got me started into microservices. But again, as I said, I wasn't actually working in a very technical capacity in that organization. I was actually a team manager of some business analysts. So I was very far removed from the technology, but I was very interested in it. Anyway, so that's why I kind of started a YouTube channel, and so I could keep my hand in with technology and actually learn about it myself. So just to be kind of clear, I've not actually implemented microservices in a production environment myself. I haven't ever done that. I only have ever kind of read about them, learned about them, yes, developed with them, but in a more kind of sandbox type environment. So, you know, that's one of the reasons for the YouTube channel, to help me learn as well as teach other people. So Envoy, yeah, it was something I kind of jumped on really through looking at Microsoft have this microservices reference architecture that they use. I think it's called eShop on containers. And I was looking at that and I was trying to actually reverse engineer that. And I was looking at the different patterns that they had adopted there. And one of the things they had that was very clear in that architecture was this concept of an API gateway. And I think they originally used something called Ocelot, which I have never used and never even looked at. But they then pivoted to Envoy, and I thought, this looks like a really interesting platform. So that's really where the idea for the video came from. Because to be honest with you, I found it quite a difficult thing to work with. The config file that you have to work with is really quite, I found it quite monstrous. The documentation is okay, but there was a lot of trial and error and a lot of digging around on Stack Overflow to get what I wanted to get working, which was a relatively simple API gateway that routed to different API endpoints.
I think you bring up a good point. I hear this a lot, especially from senior engineers, that cloud native architectures are very difficult to manage. On a previous podcast we had with Richard Lee from Ambassador Labs, said upgrading Istio to 1.9 in production is like the worst thing. It's hell. And I think it's great that even someone who has accomplished what you have accomplished can also go, hey, you know what? I'm a smart guy, but this is really difficult. And I think that's one thing that the cloud native community is just going to have to keep working on and making it simpler. Even though not everyone needs microservices, you haven't run microservices because you don't work at a company that really needs them, right? So it's a startup.
Looking at your YouTube titles and looking at what you've written about .NET, ASP.NET, and knowing that you work with clients directly on various different things, but you know, mostly a Ruby shop, how do you figure out what you're going to focus on next as far as like the next YouTube video you're going to record? You said, you know, you don't have to do microservices at scale and production. So how do you decide, oh, here's the thing I want to record? Yeah. What's your creative process and why were you interested in using Envoy to begin with to make microservices? You say you're really interested in them. What's there to be interested in?
Yeah, look, I think it's distributed computing generally is something that I think is an interesting concept. And I think it definitely has its place. I mean, one of the things I would just go back to is the whole microservices versus monolith. And I wouldn't even say which is best because I don't think there's an answer to that, is there really? So I think you look at what problems you have and then you adapt and you go with a particular solution, which is often a hybrid. So I mean, at the moment where we are predominantly a monolith, but we're probably looking at adopting, should I say, I wouldn't even call it microservices, but kind of devolved or decoupled services to some extent and using those where they make sense. But going back to why do I find microservices interesting? I think because you kind of mentioned possibly they're hard. So it's a bit of a problem. It's really not an easy thing to implement. And I totally understand why people maintain monoliths for such a long time, because going to a microservices architecture is very difficult. And so I think that just appeals to me to try and pick it apart. And I think I did mention that, again, I've looked at some reference architectures, and often what I like to do is pick them apart and kind of reverse engineer them to see if I can get them to work. Because often I can't get them to work out of the box. So they give you everything you need, you try and run them up, and there's just this whole morass of errors. So I think, yeah, it's just a puzzle or a problem that I think I want to solve, really. And that's what I find challenging and interesting about them. And then what I would then do is just focus in on a particular part of that architecture. So the API gateway, for example, was one small part of that architecture. And what I was actually thinking and doing was I wanted to develop a course on microservices. So I started to think, okay, how would I structure this course? How would you even go about teaching something like that? And the way I kind of came up with was, okay, let's break this down and focus on individual components that you would teach your audience about that made sense, both technically and from a kind of a business perspective, why they need to exist. And so, yes, I picked API Gateway, I picked Envoy, but Envoy seemed to be something that is used quite widely. It's got quite a vibrant community around it. So I thought that's probably a kind of a relatively safe bet to start focusing some video content around. I mean, that's what you want to do as well. One of the things I think in this space is there's so many things that come out all the time, and you might put your money, you might back your horse on one particular technology, and then a few months later it's gone. It's irrelevant. And as a content creator, you want to make sure you're creating content that's got some longevity to it. So that's why I picked Envoy. Number one, I think it's going to be around for a while. It's got a vibrant community around it. And yeah, it seems to do the job well in terms of what an API gateway needs to do. So that's why I picked that. And then going back to this concept of developing a course, I would then look at the different components maybe that you would need to employ in a microservices and architecture, such as the messaging between internal services. Do you go with gRPC? Do you use HTTP? Do you use a message bus? And focus in on those type of things, you know?
So Les, looking at your YouTube channel, I see a bunch of, if not most of, videos around .NET, different versions, different topics, and so on. So my question, as someone who did, I would say, the opposite, I went the opposite way, meaning I started Microsoft technology back in the day, but I left .NET when it was back in 2.1 or 2.2, I believe. I was introduced to Python and Ubuntu started becoming popular and I never looked back. I did sometimes look aside and seeing that Microsoft has changed tremendously. And if you would like, I would love to spend some time talking about the evolution of Microsoft in the last few years. Under Satya Nadella, I believe, the revolution the company and transformation the company have gone through. But to you, the first question would be, were you always around the Microsoft tech stack? But is always your focus?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So going back to my university days, it was just a total smorgasbord of technologies. In fact, that's when Java actually first kind of emerged, when I was actually still at uni. So that obviously is, well, that's gone, but that's gone. So that was something I learned about, really learned about sort of old school C languages that I've never even seen again. Eiffel, I think, was what we learned object-oriented programming with. Anyway, when I actually left an academic environment and moved into commercial environment, the company I worked for at the time, British Telecom, the team I worked in, we sold, I suppose you'd call it, telephone switching equipment to other large corporations. And the role of our team was to integrate those switches into things like an agent's desktop. So when the phone rang, this agent's desktop would spring to life. Now, the reason I'm mentioning all that is the equipment that we've sold it predominantly from a company called Nortel Networks, big Canadian telecoms company who no longer exists, unfortunately, but we worked a lot with their switching equipment and their, I suppose, application gateway that allowed us to integrate into that gateway. It was a Microsoft-based API. So it started off as something called TAPI, which was a Win32 DLL type API. And then they eventually pivoted to the Microsoft.NET framework. And that's the API, the application gateway that they provided vendors like ourselves to integrate into. So you were kind of forced in that case to use a Microsoft language. I mean, you could have got around it with using some other language, but you would have made life very difficult for yourself. So yeah, that's kind of why I was introduced to this Microsoft development ecosystem. Like a lot of people, I started with Visual Basic 6, which doesn't even exist anymore.
I love Visual Basic 6. It was a great language. I was young and I used to build tremendous applications with it in days, literally.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it had a lot of detractors, but you could do a lot with it and it was very nice to use. Then you moved to the .NET framework. And you really had two languages really to pick from, C#, Visual Basic Sharp, VB#, and I think also something called F#, which is still around, although I never looked at that. So yeah, we went with C# as the language. Actually, I got to pick what language we went with, and I chose C#, and it just stuck with me, to be honest with you. I like the language. The .NET framework, the original sort of framework, very bloated though, and when I moved to Australia, I kind of left software development behind and kind of went on my merry way. And what actually got me back into development, one of the things that got me back into it was when Microsoft brought out .NET Core, which is this kind of open source, that's a sort of secondary branch. I mean, everything's based on the .NET standard, but the, you know, they had these two frameworks then, the original monolithic legacy Windows-based .NET framework, and then this open source cross-platform version of .NET, which is really what got me interested in it again. And yeah, since then I've been using it and working with it. Feels a lot lighter, a lot less bloated. It's multi-platform. I mean, I'm running it on a Mac at the moment and it works great. Yeah, so I think there's been a lot of changes at Microsoft and I think for the most part, very positive. They've kind of opened up a lot and they've gone down a lot of open source type routes, which is nice to see. They've gone cross-platform. It feels less like they're kind of basing their whole entire shop on Windows and Office, although, I mean, they're obviously still very big products for them, but yeah, it feels a lot more open now.
Yeah, I would say one of the great signs about Microsoft transformation is the fact they actually own GitHub. They go a long way with tremendous effort not to mention it and not to show it off. Meaning they want to keep things to the community and really, I would say, immerse into this culture of open source. And they seem to be doing all the right choices over the time. One of the things that I've noticed in the last 6 to 8 months is Microsoft, I would say secret, but not so publicly known extreme support of the development of the language Rust, if you know about it. So people doesn't know that Microsoft actually poured tons of dollars into promoting and pushing this language, which is a good sign. They believe in the language and they actually going full way with this open source culture.
Yeah, I wasn't aware of that, but that they were involved in the Rust project. And that's interesting. And yeah, to your point on GitHub, I remember when it was announced that they bought it, there was quite a large vocal outpouring of, I don't know, anxiety from the developer community that, oh no, Microsoft have bought GitHub and they're going to rebadge it and tie it in with Office. And it just hasn't happened, has it? So yeah, it's good.
They're not going to screw it up. I'm glad that Microsoft bought GitHub rather than someone else. And if you told me I would say that 10 years ago, I would have said you're crazy. But, you know, the way they've come around, as Zuri just brought up, is just the transformation has been unreal.
So Liz, if we can stay on this for a moment, what would be your next book about? And don't tell me you never thought about it.
So the next book I actually had kind of off the line was actually microservices. I wanted to do a kind of this tutorial book, step-by-step tutorial book on microservices. But to be honest with you, I mean, to slightly take a step back, I left my previous role in March last year, so almost a year ago last year, and I took 6 months out just to focus on YouTube, just to focus on books and all that kind of stuff. So I spent quite a lot of time on this microservices tutorial project / book project, and it's hard. I mean, it was really hard, and I still haven't fully figured it out. So in answer to your question, I've kind of postponed it. I've not cancelled it. I've postponed the microservices book because it's going to be pretty hard to write something like that. And instead I've decided to go with maybe a book. Again, I like kind of the tutorial format, as you can probably tell. And I've thought about doing like a beginner's guide to like a full stack developer, probably within the Microsoft space predominantly, but obviously bringing in things like Docker and possibly things like Envoy, if that makes sense. So yes, I think my next book is going to be for a aspiring full stack developer and taking them all the way through everything you need to know, including things like, yeah, a professional Git workflow, pull requests, code review, all that kind of stuff, writing requirements even. So I'm still kind of scoping the book out just to define the parameters of it, because many developers might not be that interested in requirement writing, but I think it does form part of a developer's role sometimes. So yeah, that's probably what I'm going to focus on. The main problem I'm going to have now though is, what do I use as the front end kind of component? And I have been looking at Blazor recently, WebAssembly, which is really interesting, but I'm not sure that's a very marketable technology and might have to learn something like React to stand in for the kind of front end component. That's my thought at the moment.
This full stack book sounds like a great idea. You got to do it. Telling you.
Okay.
We got to assign them to Reblaze Publications. We have a new venture coming out and we're assigning you to an 8-book deal.
Oh, wow. That sounds really good, man. yeah. Okay. All I have to do now is write the book, which, you know.
And you have till next month. No pressure. It's on.
Oh, here. That's okay then. That's fine. I thought you were going to say, yeah, no problem. Next month, absolutely no issue at all.
Yeah.
So one of the things that I'm wondering, you're someone who uses YouTube as a way of teaching people how to code. And this is increasingly happening. There's people like Kent C. Dodge out there. He makes great stuff on how to use React. And it's interesting to me because you have this interesting role in the ecosystem where open source projects mostly live on GitHub at the moment. And you can go and you can write documentation for those projects. You can write PRs to add code. You can talk about them on Twitter. But you're kind of just a one level removed, right? You look at the project as a whole and say, here's something I could do with it. Here's something I could do with it. And so it's contributing back by allowing other people to learn about the open source stuff, to learn about the open source projects. And your work couldn't exist without open source. It's because it's open source that you're allowed to go in and learn all these cool technologies and figure out, okay, how would I retell this story? And you said earlier, I'm glad that they do open source things. And so you're obviously very interested in it. And I'm just wondering if you could speak more on how you feel that open source has influenced your time as a YouTube code reviewer, a code maker. What do you think?
You're absolutely correct. So, I mean, to kind of look at the flip side of the coin, I've worked for some quite large companies that have been locked in to these proprietary vendor technologies. I won't mention any names because I don't want to get litigated against, but completely closed off. So even if you wanted to learn about this particular platform X, for example, you had to buy into this company's entire document library. They would not release it. In fact, really scarily, again, I've got this particular company in mind. You couldn't, if you Googled their documentation or anything about their platform, you couldn't get it. I don't know how they managed to keep wow. their stuff so under wraps. It was unbelievable. You had to buy into their developer program, and that obviously cost money. And so coming back to your point, yeah, open source has completely changed things. And when I make videos, one of the things I do is, this is the list of things that if you want to follow along, these are the things you'll need. So you'll need a code editor. You can pick anyone you like, but you know, I choose Visual Studio Code. It's free. No, you'll need to use this. Yeah, you'll need to use this development framework. It's free. You'll need to use Docker. It's free. And basically, it's amazing. You can do this incredible stuff, and it's for your community-based developer. It's all free, open. It's incredible. And you're absolutely right. Going back 20 years, everything was kind of locked down. You had to pay for absolutely everything, and the quality wasn't even sometimes that particularly good. But you had these companies that were just locked into a technology. They had to use it. To move away from it was just more effort than it was worth, and you had these horrible lock-ins. Open source has changed all that. And I even remember when this idea of open source kind of first emerged, that all these large companies were going, oh, it's such a terrible idea for obvious reasons. They would say that it's going to be open to security vulnerabilities, and it's not going to be as good as we can do it because we pour so much money into it. And it was all about the money, obviously. So completely proven to be totally wrong. And even the organizations at Microsoft have pivoted to open source to a larger or greater extent. And yeah, I couldn't do what I do on my channel. I couldn't teach about things. I couldn't learn about things, going back to the kind of model we had 20 years ago, because you had to pay for everything, and people are just going to walk away from that, or they can't afford it. Whereas now, yeah, it's completely open. The only thing I would call out, and I was maybe going to talk about this, was cloud. And one of the things I found in making videos, whenever I do anything on cloud, and I usually use Azure just because that's kind of my wheelhouse, I find they don't tend to do as well. And I wondered, why do these videos not do quite as well as some of the other stuff? And the only thing I could come up with was that you need to provide a credit card to sign up. That's the only thing I could think of. Now, while they might not charge your credit card, and you have, you know, these free offerings, I think the big three all offer free starter stuff, I think you still need to provide this credit card to kind of sign up to it. And I think that's the only thing I can think of that puts people off playing with cloud a bit more. Yeah, which is an interesting thing. I thought I'd throw that out there. I don't know what you guys think about that. Do you think that's a barrier to entry to adopting cloud?
I think it's a really good point. I mean, one of the main things I've seen leveled against cloud technologies is that it is some sort of vendor lock-in, right? It's not entirely free in a sense, because you're using another person's service. And so they could change the service, they could change the terms, they could change the language, and then you have to update your stuff or it's gone. And I think the credit card has a way of getting in to that service is another barrier to entry. On the flip side, what I think that people who are proponents of cloud native things, and I think that's really interesting technology, so I've thought about why is it good, is because it just gives you so much more massive power than you're able to do at home. I have a really tiny NUC over there on my desk that records stuff every night, and it could only really record like a couple of things. The RAM is pathetic. I could update it maybe, but it's never going to be able to do things at scale. But if I want to do stuff at scale, having a credit card and being able to put it in is like the least of my worries. I have much bigger concerns that pretty much cloud is going to be able to help me with. So I think as far as like initial hump, yes, but it unlocks more.
I totally agree with you. I mean, I was very reticent to, I don't know why, I was very reticent to take that first step. And I was like, oh, I'm going to end up with some horrific charges here. But yeah, you take that step and you realize what you can do with it and what you have at your disposal, exactly as you say. Yeah, it's super powerful. And it's just getting people over that initial hump, I think, is exactly the point.
My only thought on that is, depending on the demographics of who watches your videos, if they're under 18, that could be a big reason why they're not doing, because they don't have access to a credit card. Or if they live in a country that just doesn't have that luxury. So that's my only thinking, but I think Richard hit it on the head.
Yeah, you're right. I think the country demographics, I mean, my largest audience is in the US, so I don't think it's really an issue for the majority of people in the US. Next largest audience is in India, so I'm not sure of the credit card situation in India, but maybe it's not as prevalent over there. I'm going to imagine no. I'm happy to be corrected on that. And even countries like the UK, credit cards were definitely not as good into talking about credit cards. But yeah, credit cards are definitely not as prevalent as they are in the US. I'm going to stop talking about credit cards now.
I would love to talk about credit cards in terms of your work in developer advocating an e-commerce company, and security, I would say, is probably a top concern. I would love to hear about what efforts are you taking as developer advocates, making sure code people are writing and using on your platform is secure. Do you guys provide guidelines, tutorials, some tools for testing? Any plans regarding to this area?
Yeah, I mean, I probably can't talk too much about it, but we've recently gone through, we want to go for, and I can't remember the certification, but there's an internet ISO security certification. So we've been going through that process.
27001, is it?
I think that's probably it. I'm not actually fully across it, but yeah, we've been going for that. So I've been involved in that to some extent. So that's as we are coming out of the startup phase and we want to kind of grow, bring on bigger clients. Yeah, you need this kind of stuff. So we've gone through all that. Thankfully, we've kind of passed, which is good. And I think we're just going through the kind of final stages of that. But to your point, yeah, I mean, part of my role is to help people using our APIs understand what they can and cannot do with or without credentials, for example. So we do expose some stuff that's publicly available, such as product listings. There's no reason why we wouldn't allow that to be consumed from the API without really the need to authenticate. But then when you start talking about, yes, orders, cart management, all that kind of stuff, that has to be absolutely 100% secured and tied down. So yeah, part of my role is to help the developers understand what they need to do in order to transact securely. Yeah, absolutely. It's a huge area. And if it goes wrong, well, I don't need to tell anybody on this session that, yeah, it can be massively damaging to any company's reputation. It can end companies, to be honest with you. Yeah.
And Richard, to your point, we're in a committing to Cloud Native podcast. And Cloud Native, the whole idea of Cloud Native is making sure using technology, portable technology, which you can take to any vendor and move around with freedom. So vendor may be locked you in with other technology, but not with cloud native. And committing to cloud native is the way to go.
I agree. Awesome. Les, it is around time to wrap up this episode. So before we do so, I want to make sure people know where to find you online just a last time, because you said at the very beginning that you're not a marketer, and it's been very clear to me this entire conversation, nothing about marketing. That's not true. You're obviously very brilliant at marketing.
Yeah.
Where can people find you online?
Thousands of YouTube subscribers.
Okay, yeah. Wait, before we wrap up, I just got to bring this up. This is how great his videos are. He has a video that has 890 upvotes and not one downvote. Like, has anyone ever seen that? Like, that's unheard of. There you go. So, yeah. There I just had to bring go, that
man.
Up.
You've probably just jinxed that now, because I do check. I think I know the video you're talking about. I do check that. I go, how is that possible?
Right. Okay. Probably, so you were thinking it too.
So somebody now is going to go and go, I'm going to downvote that now, but hopefully they don't. But
We have... Our listeners are awesome. They're mature and they would never do something like that.
That's good.
And if they do, they can no longer listen.
Okay. Yeah. I'm just joking. Yeah. But you can find me. Look, yeah, just Google my name. I mean, that sounds a bit pompous, but yeah, that will bring up the YouTube channel. So Les Jackson. And yeah, from the YouTube channel, that's kind of my central hub where you can kind of find me on Twitter and my blog and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, YouTube's my central kind of launching off point.
Les, that's L-E-S.
Jackson,
that's Twitter right. Is Binary Thistle, as we said earlier.
That's right.
Les, this was excellent. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for waking up early. I believe it's 6:50 in the morning where you are. So I'm super grateful.
Yeah, thanks.
That's
man.
Right. That's right. It's my pleasure. I really enjoyed the talk. And anytime. It was really good. It was really enjoyable. So thank you for the opportunity to talk to you guys. It was great.
Updates this week from Reblaze. Well, we're actually really excited about this one. We get to tell you to go listen to another podcast. I know we shouldn't be doing that, but why not? Cross-linking is the best. So kubelist.com/podcast. That's KUBE, obviously, from Kubernetes. have interviewed Justin and Zuri Bar-Yochai. So if you liked hearing them talk about really cool stuff at Reblaze, go listen to kubeless.com/podcast. Otherwise, check in next week for another fantastic Committing to Cloud Native experience. Thank you all.